loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll discuss the report that just came out today from the Department of Justice's Inspector General's office about former FBI head James Comey's conduct during the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. And then we turn to our regular Thursday segment on criminal injustice with Paul Wright. We'll discuss how his publication, Prison Legal News, isn't being allowed in Florida prisons because they advertise for pen pals, and the huge expansion of the so-called gang database in New York City under Mayor Bill de Blasio.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, a federal judge today refused to dismiss a lawsuit by an American journalist challenging his apparent placement on a kill list by U.S. authorities in Syria. The ruling clears the way for Bilal Abdelkarim to seek answers and try to clear his name after what he says were five near misses by U.S. airstrikes in Syria after he was mistaken for a militant. Next, the United Nations General Assembly voted 120-8. With 45 abstentions to condemn Israel for its lethal use of force against Palestinian demonstrators in Gaza. Only the United States, Israel, Australia, and five tiny Pacific Island countries opposed the measure, which also called on the UN to make recommendations on how to protect Palestinians. Then, four major human rights groups said today that the government of Ukraine is failing to respond adequately to attacks by far-right groups against marginalized communities in the country. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Freedom House, and Frontline Defenders said in a report that ethnic minorities, women's activists, and LGBTQ groups are particularly targeted. And then a storage site holding half of Baghdad's ballot boxes from Iraq's recent parliamentary election in May caught fire this week in what appears to have been an act of arson ahead of a countrywide vote recount. Many parliamentarians are now even calling for the election to be rerun. Meanwhile, negotiations for the formation of a new government move forward as Iraqi leader Muqtada as-Sadr announces an alliance with a coalition associated with the Shiite militias that fought ISIS and are close to Iran. And finally, Saudi and Emirati military forces continue to attack the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah today, pushing the country closer to a humanitarian crisis. The port of Hodeidah is the only way that millions of Yemenis can get food and medicine. The United Nations estimates that 8 million people are at risk for starvation. And in other headlines, New York's Attorney General filed a proceeding today to dissolve the Trump Foundation after allegations that it has operated as a slush fund for the Trump campaign. The press release includes an email from campaign manager Corey Lewandowski to someone at the Trump Foundation asking for disbursements while he was in Iowa. Yesterday, for the first time, reporters were led into Casa Padre, the Walmart that's been converted into a holding facility for children of immigrant parents who have been separated at the border. There are 1,400 immigrant boys who are being held in this strange Brownsville, Texas facility. The Supreme Court today announced a decision in the Minnesota Voters Alliance versus Mansky case, opening up polling places for political apparel. This was a 7-2 decision on a First Amendment argument, and it'll strike down Minnesota's law banning clothing with political messages in polling places. Electricity blackouts started today in South Africa after union strikes prevented the electricity company, Eskom, from meeting demand. The company has refused, however, to raise pay. Eskom has been entangled in corruption scandals for years. The blackouts are controlled and planned to take effect between 5:40 p.m. and 8 p.m. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a new analysis of the Department of Justice Inspector General's report that was just released today at 2 o'clock. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the release of the Department of Justice Inspector General's report. We are joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. She is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we're joined from Virginia by Joe Loria. He is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hello there.
So, Joe, let's start with you. I mean, this, from beginning to end, this investigation of Hillary Clinton's email server was a political investigation. I mean, it was done in the middle of an election campaign. She was, you know, the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party. What's your takeaway now that this Inspector General report came out?
Well, I think it may have been better had he just laid out the facts that he uncovered and left it at that, because there are facts in here that do not jive with his interpretation. This is the problem I find. For example, he makes clear, he reveals a new text message between Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, two FBI agents, who we already knew hated Trump and loved Hillary. But at one point, this one was released, that's from Lisa, who says, "Trump's never going to become president, right?" Right? And Strzok replies, no, he's not. We'll stop it. But that then the inspector general says that he also says that Strzok then has improperly prioritized the Russia investigation over the Clinton email investigation. So we've got that email, that text exchange, and we have the inspector general saying he made Russia the priority, Russia investigation priority over the Clinton email. But then he comes to the conclusion that there was no political bias by anyone at the FBI. So I don't understand how he can come to that conclusion. I think we're going to have to depend on the Senate and House Intelligence Committees doing their own investigation into this. Of course, they'll be accused of being politically biased because they are Republican-led, and they will be motivated by partisan politics, which is unfortunate, which will undermine their conclusions. But I don't think we can stop. From what I know of this report that was released today, I don't think this is the end of it.
Colleen, yesterday, Attorney General Sessions said that when the report comes out, if there need to be firings, there will be firings. Well, most of the people being criticized have already left government. There are a handful still around. Peter Strzok is the most obvious one. Is it realistic that that his head is going to roll, or others will?
You know, if Strzok is the only one who has not already left or been fired, I kind of think he might be trying to hang on. And, you know, I think that they would have a probably, it's hard to say. The FBI rarely fires anyone. They usually force people to resign. That's usually been the old mode, because that reduces the embarrassment is nobody knows why the person left. In this case, Strzok, it's well known that he his texts with Page. But I kind of, it's hard to say. I really don't know, but I doubt that anyone's going to be fired. Ray seems to be kind of just playing it by the middle here and not really taking any radical steps either way.
I want to read from the executive summary of this report that was issued by the DOJ Inspector General. It's a very, very long report, over 500 pages. You know, reporters are just working their way through it. But there's an executive summary at the beginning. And one of the main areas of focus of this investigation, of this report, was the so-called endgame discussions, where basically at a certain point in 2016, around the spring of 2016, the investigative team, which is referred to as the mid-year team in the report, they or the mid-year investigation, they more or less determined that, you know, there weren't going to be any criminal charges filed against Hillary Clinton. And so they began discussing, well, how are we going to break the news, considering that this is an election year? You know, Hillary Clinton is likely going to be one of the candidates in the general election. So here's part of the executive summary from the Inspector General's report. Although Comey engaged with the department in these, quote, endgame discussions, he told us that he was concerned that involvement by then Attorney General Loretta Lynch in a declination announcement, meaning that they were going to decline to file charges, would result in, quote, corrosive doubt about whether the decision was objective and impartial, because Lynch was appointed by a president from the same political party as Clinton. Joe Loria, what do you think about that, what I just read there? And also, I mean, it didn't mention it, but the tarmac meeting between Loretta Lynch and President Bill Clinton, I think that's kind of like a bigger deal, right?
Yeah, well, that came to my mind immediately, that the tarmac was not mentioned in that. But guess who mentioned it? Was Comey himself in his testimony. And one of the testimonies he gave, he made it clear that the reason he went beyond the protocol that he was given, which was to simply make a recommendation in that press conference in July of 2016 about whether to prosecute Clinton or not, he went beyond that recommendation and said that she should not be, and that no reasonable prosecutor would, and that while there was gross negligence there, he went on to blast her but would not back any kind of charges. Well, Comey admitted the reason he went beyond the rules there, essentially, is because of that tarmac discussion, that he felt his boss, Loretta Lynch, who I don't even know is mentioned, or if she's in any way censured by this report, had that meeting with Bill Clinton. And they both claim, of course, they didn't talk about it. But even the meeting itself, just seeing the former president there at all on her plane would have some kind of, could have some kind of influence on her decision. It was clearly not the right thing for Bill Clinton to do. It was not, Lynch's should not have let him on the plane. And Comey himself admits this. Now, you know, the thing is, Comey, if you look, he said that she had no motive, no intent to mishandle classified information. Well, the statute is clear that intent is not important. It's whether you mishandle it or not. Now, because it was in the middle of a political campaign, it's not a surprise that she was not going to be prosecuted for this. And as you pointed out to me before the show, Walter, that the report says that both Comey and others had their own private email service as well. So maybe that was also influencing their decision not to go after Clinton because they were doing the same things themselves. I find this report, for what I know of it so far, to be very strange in its pointing out things that look like serious misconduct, but concluding that it wasn't. I'd like to know what Colleen thinks about Horowitz because she would know better than I do. Is he really a serious inspector general, or is he circling the wagons here and protecting the reputation of the department and the FBI?
That's really the question, isn't it? Colleen, is Horowitz a serious inspector general? And if he is, do you agree with his assessment that it doesn't appear, at least, that any crimes were committed?
You know, I don't know too much about Horowitz. I know more about the prior inspector generals when I was working. And one thing that they all have in common is trying to split the baby when a final report comes out. Even in a case where Frederick Whitehurst was a very valid whistleblower about the FBI lab, I think it was Bromwich, he still had to, you know, find a way to criticize the whistleblower, as well as say, well, the FBI has really a long ways to go in getting accreditation, et cetera, et cetera. So they try to do this, and they give time to the agency to try to respond. And so it does come out where they are kind of like talking out of both sides of their mouth a little bit. From all the reports I read about this, you know, from I don't know if there were leaks or whatever, but there were reports that saying that he would the report would kind of be a nothing burger in a sense that they were saying, you know, a couple of things. And it's a little bit of what Joe Lauria is saying. In some places, it looks like they should have found. Now, I will just say the contrast here is the firing of McCabe for giving an interview or for okaying an interview. And for criticizing Comey for, you know, so-called insubordination and not following the advice of DOJ officials. So those things really seem relatively minor compared to a lot of other much more serious things that, you know, much more serious errors. The fact that you okay an interview, and in some cases in work, you have to, if the press is going to publish a story where they have wrong facts, you have to somehow criticize the errors in the press. So I found that kind of funny that Horowitz came down so hard on McCabe for simply this wrong interview. And yet, when the final report comes out, there really is no real finding of wrongdoing, which they could have found. And of course, he didn't look into things like the why the FBI did not try to verify that Steele dossier. You know, that to me is a much huger thing. When they get information like this, why don't they look into it? Well, I don't think Horowitz was, that's maybe been looked at by somebody else, but Horowitz was not, that wasn't part of his investigation.
Colleen, I want to stay with you for a second because a significant part of the report is dedicated to an assessment of the investigative techniques that were used in the course of this investigation into Clinton's email server. And they, you know, there's some terminology that I think would be confusing to most people. So I'm reading from this executive summary at the beginning of the IG report. So, you know, one of the things they looked at was decisions by the team to, quote, enter into letter use or queen for a day immunity agreements with three witnesses, and the use of consent agreements and, quote, active production immunity to obtain the laptops used by Clinton's attorneys, Cheryl Mills and Heather Samuelson, to call her personal and work-related emails. Can you just tell us what those things are? So like a letter use or queen for a day immunity or active production immunity? And are those common investigative techniques, or does this sort of raise a red flag?
You know, I think those are common. They often, if you really want to get to the bottom of something, you know, there is no other way in some cases other than to give immunities. And there are different types of immunity. You know, there could be an immunity that you will never prosecute the person no matter what. That would be full immunity. But then these other things are just what they say. Queen for a day, I believe, is just what you say on that particular moment. They can't use against you in a later proceeding. And I think that, yes, I think they're pretty common. And in a case like this, I know there was a lot of criticism that they did not really attempt to get to the bottom of it. Of course, if they had, as Joe Loria just explained, you know, the fact that you have presidential campaigns going on at the same time as this investigation, I don't think can but affect the investigation. Even though people say there's no bias, how can it not affect the investigation? And clearly it's the backdrop. And it affects everything in terms of what would be the norm. When you talk about what would be the norm with a normal person out there and what would be the norm with a presidential candidate, I think it's very, very different.
Joe, let's go back to you. There are a couple like very noticeable changes. I found this to be some of the most interesting information in the report, that there is this draft statement that Comey put together. He shared it with FBI senior leadership on May 2nd, and this was going to be, you know, he was sort of practicing how he would break the news to the public that they weren't pressing charges. So here's one of the bullet points. The description of Clinton's handling of classified information was changed from, quote, grossly negligent to, quote, extremely careless. So that's grossly negligent, like that's a criminal charge, right? And so it was changed to extremely careless. I mean, what do you think about that? It kind of goes back to what you were saying, and I think your first response, that, you know, this is a little odd because it describes, you know, pretty gross misconduct, but doesn't really call for much concrete action to be taken.
Yeah, and on top of that, the report says that FBI officials demonstrated, quote, a willingness to take official action, close quote, to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president. That decision to make that change, which Peter Strzok, I believe, had something to do with as well, was part of that. So the Inspector General is saying that people in the FBI, senior officials, had a willingness to take official action to stop Donald Trump from becoming president. Peter Strzok said, we will stop it. And yet this report never looks into, as Colleen pointed out, the Steele dossier, whether it should have been taken seriously at all to begin with, as it was a piece of opposition research, not a piece of intelligence. It was never vetted. It's full of all kinds of slander. That's what an opposition research document is, that it was used to get a warrant to surveil a member of Trump's team. This report does not, at least the executive summary that I just searched, does not mention Stephen Halper, who the FBI put into the Trump campaign, supposedly to investigate relations with Russia. That happened even a month before the investigation in July 2016 of the FBI investigation began. And Mr. Halper had the role in 1980 of going into infiltrating the Carter re-election campaign on behalf of the Reagan campaign, and was involved in stealing a briefing book before a presidential debate. So he went in there on a partisan basis to disrupt and to spy on a political campaign, a presidential re-election campaign on behalf of the Democrat or Republican challenger. And here he shows up inside the Trump campaign. That's not even mentioned in this report. Why did the Inspector General even bother saying something like there were senior officials willing to take official action to stop Trump from becoming president, and Peter Strzok saying, we will stop it if he's not going to come to a different conclusion? I think this is very, very odd. It's exactly, I think, what Colleen was saying, trying to split the baby in half. But in this case, one half of the baby has what seems like damning evidence, or at least something that demands a greater follow-up, and the other half of the baby, which says there was nothing improper done here. It's pretty extraordinary.
Colin, here's another quote I want to get your thoughts on from the report. It goes, much like with his July 5th announcement, we found that in making this decision, Comey engaged in ad hoc decision-making, the decision to, you know, announce the findings. Based on his personal views, even if it meant rejecting long-standing department policy or practice, we found unpersuasive Comey's explanation as to why transparency was more important than department policy and practice with regard to the reactivated mid-year investigation. What is policy and practice? Is there really policy and practice for a case like this, or is it really just comes down to political calculations?
Yes, that's actually a good question. And on top of that, I think I'm not a fan of Comey for a lot of reasons, but mostly my criticism was based on Comey and Mueller's sycophancy after 9/11, where they were following their bosses. They were simply rubber stamping things that came out of from John Yoo, saying that, you know, torture was not illegal, warrantless monitoring, etc. All of the things, roundups, you know, without charges that Mueller was involved in right after 9/11. All of those things were not thinking for themselves and really using integrity. They were just simply like following orders or whatever. So you can kind of see, as Comey has, you know, all these years, 17 years now, and he gets grilled when he's nominated for FBI director. Al Franken in Minnesota grilled him on why he had rubber stamped the so-called enhanced interrogation tactics. So you can almost imagine someone learning from the mistakes of following these political bosses who are telling you to do these things. And now later on, it's found out to be illegal and you're not making up your own mind. I have to say, I sympathize with Comey not following a Department of Justice official to let Loretta Lynch or whatever, or someone else in DOJ make the announcement after she's met on the tarmac, for instance. And he's got that sense now that he knows that ultimately, these things that are being covered up or whatever may be found out. So going back to the whole thing with Comey, I think that this situation of having two presidential candidates under FBI investigation in the weeks and days before an election is totally unprecedented. There is no policy to deal with something like this. In fact, we could have said we were in a constitutional crisis, even though very few people recognized it at the time. It already was one. And I actually, again, I'm not a fan of him for a lot of reasons, et cetera. And he does do a lot of grandstanding and he believes himself kind of holier than thou. But in this case, I think you have to sympathize with someone who is trying to almost skate on a situation where there was so much wrongdoing and corruption that it was hard to know what to really say or do it to make it, to make it the best. Comey certainly believed that Trump was going to lose. And I think that mindset that Hillary Clinton was going to win, which everyone pretty much had, definitely affected his decision making before the election.
This can be treated then as the proverbial learning experience, right? What is the learning experience? What do we learn from this thing? What's going to change in the future? Joe, how about you?
You really put me on the spot there. I don't know if anything is going to be learned from this. Honestly, what we probably already knew was the Inspector General of the FBI is independent up to a point, and he's going to lay out some facts that don't coincide with his conclusions, but that's not probably the first time that's happened and won't be the last time. What we might hope to do is in the nominating process in the next presidential election or the ones after that, that the voters don't vote for someone who's under investigation or under suspicion, that we don't get to that situation again. But, you know, this is not something that we can count on. I really don't know if there are going to be any lessons learned here. I think there's another point here that Comey, under the kind of pressure that he was under from his own people, particularly from the New York Bureau, the New York FBI office, to do something about Clinton after she was let free, according to the way they saw it. So he announced, of course, or sent a letter that he knew would be leaked to Congress saying that new emails were found on Anthony Weiner's laptop. That's mentioned here. But again, it doesn't really criticize him too much for doing that. He was in a very difficult situation, as Colleen said. He had to tell Congress that he knew it would be leaked. But, of course, he exonerated her within a week, a couple of days before the actual vote. But she has always blamed Comey for that decision as one of the main reasons why she lost.
Colleen, this is just the beginning of the fallout over this report, and of course it's going to bleed over into other issues, particularly the ongoing Mueller investigation of Donald Trump and the Trump campaign. You know, later today, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, is going to have a press conference that's at 5:30 today, so very shortly. And later today, Trump's legal team is going to huddle. They're going to talk about how they can, you know, respond to this and what it means about, you know, FBI impartiality generally. You know, how much overlap do you see between, you know, this investigation in the past and the ongoing Mueller special counsel investigation?
Well, I think there's a lot of overlap, and it will affect whether Mueller can charge obstruction of justice to some extent, because it's undermining Comey. And so it kind of does seem to bolster Trump's opinion that Comey was not trustworthy, wouldn't follow orders, etc. So it bolsters Trump a little bit. I think both political sides will try to make as much hay out of this as possible. And unfortunately, Horowitz is allowing that. The question about what should be learned, I mean, I instead of asking what will be learned, which I'm pessimistic about as well, what should be learned is that this FISA court itself, if they want to show that they have any integrity, the FISA court or the FISA Court of Appeals should take some of these issues up. And they should themselves, it would be nice for once if they didn't have a secret proceeding, but actually have something that's more public. I think that that would be something a little more trustworthy. And the other thing is that the Congress people who have voted to expand this monitoring should learn the lesson that the monitoring and this surveillance is not just on average people out there. It is really being focused for political purposes. And so why they would vote to expand the warrantless spying, monitoring, whatever, as they have just done, makes no sense. They should be learning the lesson that they themselves are some of the main targets of this. And I'm just kind of surprised that they don't learn that. A lot of them, even Nunes, voted to keep the monitoring going this way. And you know, this should be something that they should be picking up on, is that these powers can be abused. And by and large, they are, you know, being used for political purposes.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. She's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we were joined from Virginia by Joe Loria. He's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we're going to continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, and he's also the editor of Prison Legal News. We're joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Roussel. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So, Paul, let's start with you. Your publication, Prison Legal News, has been in the news lately regarding the censorship of that publication. Tell us about that.
Well, this is kind of the latest round. We've been censored by the Florida Department of Corrections since 2009. They ostensibly have been censoring us since 2009 because of our advertising content. They claim that ads for pen pals and postage stamps are somehow a threat to prison security, which no other prison system in the country or jail thinks is the case. And so we've been litigating it ever since, and we had a trial in 2015, which unfortunately we lost most of, and we appealed it to the 11th Circuit, and in a pretty vitriolic anti-free speech decision, the 11th Circuit upheld the censorship. So now we're headed to the Supreme Court to see if we can hopefully try and get them to reverse this.
Paul, I recall Human Rights Defense Center suing other state departments of corrections over their policies allowing prisoners to have only postcards, not to have letters or magazines. Was that not a precedent? I recall you winning those lawsuits.
Yes, we have. We've literally won dozens of lawsuits. At last count, I think we've won over 60 or 70 lawsuits around the censorship of our magazine and our books and that. But this is basically the Florida DOC, rather than get into arguing over the content of the magazine, which changes with every issue, instead they targeted the one thing that stays the same in every issue and has stayed the same for pretty much the last 25 years or so, which is our advertising content. So by focusing on the advertising content, they come up with something they can censor us on in every issue, and they claimed, even though they never produced any evidence, that this was somehow a security threat. And these are all for services that Prison Legal News, the Human Rights Defense Center, we don't provide any of these services. We're just carrying the ads for it. This is like censoring prison officials censoring the New York Times because they carry ads for vodka or cars, and they say, well, prisoners aren't allowed to own cars or vodka in prison. So we're going to censor the New York Times for having those ads. And it's kind of like the same logic here. And so rather than banning the prohibited conduct, they're banning us for carrying the ads for it. And part of the thing that's bizarre is that a lot of the conduct that they claim is objectionable, they don't even ban that. For example, one of the things they claim is a problem is that we have one or two ads for businesses that purchase postage stamps, and also a number of businesses, including Prison Legal News, we accept postage stamps as payment from prisoners. And so they say this is a problem. But the Florida Department of Corrections allows prisoners to have postage stamps. So they haven't banned postage stamps. So they let them have postage stamps, but they're censoring us because we have ads about accepting postage stamps as payment, the very same stamps that they let prisoners have and give to them. So we've maintained all along that the censorship is pretextual, and that the real problem they've got is with our editorial content, where we report on the massive levels of brutality and corruption and sleaze and misconduct that occur in the Florida Department of Corrections. So that's a real problem. And so unfortunately, we lost at the appellate court level. So we're literally left with the Supreme Court as our court of last resort here.
Yeah, you all have, Prison Legal News has reported on a number of really, really galling stories going on in the Florida Department of Corrections. One of them, I recall when the Florida prison guards scalded a man to death in a hot shower. From what I recall, there are a number of really horrific stories that you all have done the really important reporting on, since no one else really talks about it.
Yes, and part of the thing is that the critical thing is that for Florida prisoners, Prison Legal News is the main source of information they have to get this information. Even though other media outlets have reported on these stories, like the Miami Herald, the Palm Beach Post, they've all done fantastic jobs reporting on some of these abuses. But the problem is that very few prisoners can afford a daily newspaper subscription in the prison system, whereas they can all afford, or most of them, or many of them can afford, Prison Legal News subscriptions. And that's one of the critical things, is that prior to this ban, we had 300 to 400 subscribers in the Florida Department of Corrections. And over the years, that's pretty much withered away to nothing, as they consistently censor all copies of Prison Legal News.
How does the process of prison censorship work? I mean, can they basically make up, invent whatever reason they want prison authorities, or is there some sort of legal standard or legal test that they have to have in mind?
Well, that's part of the problem, is that generally they kind of make stuff up as they go. And in the 28 years that Prison Legal News has been publishing, we've been censored on everything from the basis of the postage rate that we pay, the paper we are printed on, whether or not we have staples, the fact that I was in prison when we were publishing the magazine and I was the editor. The Nevada Department of Corrections said that to the extent they had rules that banned prisoners from writing letters to each other, that if the magazine had a prisoner editor, that somehow made the magazine correspondence, and they would therefore ban it on that basis. We've been banned on whether or not prisoners paid for the magazine from their prison trust accounts or not. So, I mean, basically, the basis for censorship is literally limited only by the imagination of the censors. And they come up with and part of the thing is they try coming up with lots of reasons to censor us that apply across the board, so they don't have to say that a specific issue or a specific article is somehow a threat to prison security. But the Virginia DOC at one point, they subjected us to a blanket ban because they said the magazine as a whole and every issue cast law enforcement in a negative light. That was their exact basis for doing so.
Ridiculous. It's a news magazine.
Well, and the big thing was when I asked the head of the of their publications review committee, and I was like, you know, so specifically, like, what articles are you finding objectionable? And he says, well, just in your latest issue, you've got this article about Virginia women prisoners settling a lawsuit over being raped by DOC guards. And I'm like, well, you're not claiming it didn't happen, right? You're not claiming the rapes didn't happen, because the court's already established that they did happen. The state's paying out a chunk of money to compensate the victims of the sexual assaults. So you don't say, no, this is true. And he said, no, I'm not saying it's not true. I'm saying it is true, but you reporting on it makes law enforcement look bad. And I'm kind of like, well, if your employees stop raping and killing people, we'll stop reporting on it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the guards themselves, the police themselves, are making themselves look bad by doing the actions, right?
Well, that was my argument, and of course, that was beyond the pale, apparently, because apparently in some quarters, the notion is that if you don't, you know, we don't want to stop the abuse of government power so much as stop the reporting on it. And we proceeded to litigate that case for the next 2 years, and we eventually won that case. But I think that's the mentality, and I think that if you're in a position where you have the governmental authority and the power that you can shut down any media criticism that you don't like, you know, I mean, that's a lot of power to have. And you know, and ideally you think that your government employees or your government officials are professional enough and respectful enough of the Constitution to not give in to such urges. Unfortunately, you know, we don't live in that world. And like I say, here in Florida, they've been really vigorous about, you know, censoring us and keeping us out of the Florida prison system. And again, this is the context that, you know, it's a prison system that's incredibly brutal. It's, you know, it's very cruel. And there really is no type of accountability or oversight over the Florida Department of Corrections. This allows the situation to fester and continue, if not get worse.
Yeah. I think it's a two-way kind of power valve here, too, because we've talked in the show about how Department of Corrections are rarely... Well, they are increasingly in the news, but often they are able to keep such tight control over what goes on and over the news that gets out of the prison, because most prisons, you know, have such strict contraband rules. And unlike South Carolina, where we've talked about where there are a lot of cell phones, they've been able to kind of keep really tight control and not let stories out. So there's that method of power. But then there's also the power of what the information that actually comes in, right? And we've seen nearby here in Maryland, there was a municipality that started to limit what types and what numbers of books, and I know that has happened in many places across the country, just because, right, if you have a knowledgeable, educated prison population, then that is going to be that much harder to kind of keep power over and keep control over.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, absolutely. And I think that this is also one of the things that I think that we've seen so much opposition and so much energy by prison and jail officials to keep prison legal news out of prisons and jails is because a population that's rights conscious and rights knowledgeable is a harder population to manage. When I went to prison, one of the first things that I was told was that a prisoner, I didn't have any rights. And I didn't really know any better. And I was thinking, well, gosh, that seems kind of weird to me. But it actually took a couple years and reading books about prisoners' rights and the law and how the Constitution applied in the prison context, it made me realize that, you know, well, yeah, a lot of prison employees wish the Constitution and the law didn't apply in prisons. But, you know, that's just wishful thinking and fantasy on their part. But the real problem is getting it to apply. And when you have a prison population and a jail population that is, compared to the rest of the general population of the United States, very disproportionately mentally ill, very disproportionately functionally illiterate, you know, it's a challenge to educate that population about what their rights are and what their remedies are. And it's also a two-way street. You know, we don't just want to let the prisoners know what their rights are and what's going on. We also want to educate the public about what's happening inside prisons and jails. And You know, so that's kind of like the two-way street of information. And as far as prison officials are going, they really want to keep everyone in the dark. They don't want the public to know what's going on in prisons and jails under their control. And the flip side is they also don't want the prisoners to know what their rights are, much less how to do anything about enforcing them. And so that's kind of the quandary that we have.
Paul, I'd like to switch topics for a moment and talk about immigration and the detention of undocumented immigrants. It's been in the news a lot lately, especially this policy of separating families at the border. We've all seen on social media sites pictures of young children in cages, either alone or with other children without their parents. And we've also seen news in the past week of about 1,600 ICE detainees being sent to federal prisons around the country. Now, when I was in prison, we had some ICE detainees, and I asked one why exactly he was in prison. And he said, well, you know, crossing the border without a visa is a crime. And for a first offense, you can get 5 years. And for a second, you can get 8 years. And for a third, you can get up to 20 years in prison. Well, that was just a handful of people that we had in FCI Loretto. Now we're talking about 1,600 people that have been arrested just in the last couple of weeks. Where do you see this going in light of the fact that just in the last day or two, people like Paul Ryan and Bob Corker have come out against this policy of separating family?
Well, I think it's important to note that basically this is just a policy that the administration has put in place to dissuade people from fleeing, you know, their countries and seeking asylum in this country. And I think that part of the problem is this whole notion that what they're doing is somehow illegal. But, you know, refugees have a right to seek asylum in other countries. And I think what's happening with most of these cases, these people that are coming to the United States, they're not fleeing from Border Patrol or U.S. immigration officials. In fact, they're locating them and turning themselves in so they can petition for asylum. You know, this isn't a case of people, you know, quote, sneaking across the border and hiding. They're crossing the border, they're finding immigration authorities, and they're requesting asylum, which is something that under international law, everyone has a right to do. And the administration is taking this position of basically imprisoning the parents, charging them with a crime, and then using that as a basis to separate them from their children, putting the children in the foster care. But this is all being done with the goal of dissuading people from entering the United States to seek asylum. You know, I don't think anyone is claiming that, you know, this is some change in the law, because, I mean, the law hasn't changed. It's the same law that's been on the book for decades. And it's nothing else is changing, but what they're doing is they're instituting this policy with the goal of intimidating people to keep them from coming to the U.S. And I think it's worth looking at a little bit of history. I think, you know, I know John's old enough to remember this, but this goes back to like the 1980s when the U.S. was funding these Central American dictatorships, and American-funded and trained death squads were murdering tens of thousands of people, and we saw this huge exodus of refugees from Central America fleeing this violence and fleeing these wars and coming to the United States, and pretty much they were met with the same tactics. I mean, everything was being done to try to dissuade them from entering the United States, everything except, of course, having you know, less repressive regimes in their homeland so people would stay, and having a little bit more economic opportunity rather than societies where 12 families pretty much run the whole show and own everything. And that's been kind of what generates the refugees. But rather than try to address those conditions in their home countries, which, you know, the United States largely won these wars against leftist guerrillas in the 1990s, and this is kind of like the face of victory. And so instead, rather than try to address those conditions, the big thing is just to try and keep people from fleeing their countries and to live in these horrific conditions that have come about since these U.S.-backed wars ended, and nothing really changed. So instead, now the thing is, let's intimidate the refugees by threatening to take their children and locking them up in cages and separating them from their families. And that's the big solution to the problem.
Absolutely. And I would add that I don't know that all of those U.S.-backed wars are over in the first place, but absolutely. And it's
the resistance is over.
Yeah, no, that might be right. There's still some resistance going on. But yeah, I totally hear you. I think that's totally right. It's also just, it's insane, especially this week in particular. We're seeing all of these like really large numbers, the 1,600 detained that we were talking about, the Casa Padre, you know, thousands of or at least hundreds of young immigrant boys being kind of kept in what was an old Walmart because they've been separated from their parents, being fed kind of, you know, from the what used to be a McDonald's and the Walmarts. It's just absolutely nuts. It doesn't make any actual sense.
One of the things that I think is very important that was reported by Reuters this morning is that almost none of these undocumented immigrants have any kind of a criminal record. It's terrible, I think, for both them and even for the prison guards that here you have these very vulnerable people. They've never been in a prison setting before, and they're being overseen by corrections officers, security staff, who have spent their entire careers with hardened criminals serving long sentences for, in many cases, terrible crimes. And they're only trained to deal with people like that. They're not trained to deal with people who are only there because the government has forced them there, you know, just to give them a bed and keep them in one place until they can be thrown out. So you have a potential, really, for something terrible to happen. For a prison guard to overreact, for example, or frankly, for an immigrant to have some sort of a mental or emotional breakdown because almost none of them have ever been in a situation like this before.
Yeah, I mean, I would add that I think so many actually in our prisons are people who, you know, were just put there because the government needed a bed for them, right? I mean, so many folks have committed these tiny infinitesimal crimes or even big ones, but were kids and were traumatized when they were younger. But in any case, I totally hear you. And I think, you know, immigrating to another country is not something that most people do voluntarily, right? Like this is, as we've talked about, people are coming here hoping for some sort of refugee status because they're escaping all the violence we've been talking about. And it's traumatic. You're getting here and you're completely traumatized. You probably don't speak a ton of English, especially right. If you're in an area where people have really thick accents from the South or the Midwest
and
or wherever, right?
And I can promise you
right?
that and most prison guards do not speak Spanish.
Absolutely not. So, you know, that I think is yet another layer. You're not only stressed out and traumatized and separated from your kids in a cage in terrible conditions, but you also have no idea what the guards are yelling at you as they potentially beat you.
Interestingly, too, the prison guards union has protested this new Justice Department policy, because prison guards are not trained for this kind of thing. Frankly, they're not paid for this kind of thing. And the unions themselves are afraid that something terrible is going to happen. I want to make one more point. I want to turn it over to you, Paul. The Reuters article is talking about FCI Victorville, the Federal Correctional Institution at Victorville, California. And Victorville is a medium security prison. It's a dangerous place. Well, instead of putting these undocumented immigrants in a camp or even in a low security facility that, you know, has a fence and barbed wire, whatever, they're putting them in a medium security prison. Now, medium, it has the steel doors, the guard towers with, you know, people with rifles. I mean, this is a serious, honest to God prison. Why would they do that, Paul, when so many of the low security prisons have plenty of room in them?
And again, I think this goes back to the whole intimidation factor. And I think that, you know, Nicole raised a good point, too, about, you know, a lot of the people that are being caged by the Border Patrol and by the federal government, they're coming to the U.S. with trauma. They're fleeing violent situations. And also the other fact is that the separation has on the children as well. But I just did a radio interview, or I did a television interview last weekend with Univision about the death of Marco Antonio Munoz. He was a Honduran immigrant who was separated from his wife and his three-year-old child at the border. He was so distraught that immigration officials sent him to a local jail where he hanged himself. And this is also about the lack of transparency and the secrecy, is that basically no one knew that he was in custody, much less that he'd killed himself, until some anonymous official in the Border Patrol or ICE, one of those agencies, they someone leaked the news of the suicide to the Washington Post, where it then got reported by the Post, and that's been picked up by other media. But I think, you know, we've got a lot of, there's just so many issues here. We've got a lack of transparency. We've got secrecy. The fact that this man who was seeking asylum was separated from his family and then died, and then no one bothers telling the media about it until a month later after the fact. And even then, it was only because an anonymous whistleblower in one of those federal agencies was outraged or concerned enough about this death to disclose it to the national media, that if that whistleblower hadn't done it, we probably still wouldn't know that that this man had killed himself. So, you know, so we've got all these problems, and again, this is also a thing where, as a matter of international law, people are doing what they have a right to do, which is to seek asylum in another country, and the U.S. is basically criminalizing and punishing asylum seekers because they're coming from countries that the U.S. Doesn't want them from. Whereas, you know, I think one of the things, too, is if you look at the difference between, as someone who lives here in Florida, I'm acutely aware of how Cuban refugees are treated versus Honduran or Guatemalan or Salvadorian ones. Here in the U.S., refugees from Cuba that managed to make it to dry land, basically they turn themselves in to the Border Patrol in terms of seeking asylum, and they're immediately, you know, they're not arrested. They're immediately processed. They're given papers, and they actually get benefits and assistance from the government because they're fleeing from a regime that the United States is an official enemy with. But again, the nature of people seeking political asylum and people seeking asylum, it doesn't depend on, at least it shouldn't depend on how friendly or unfriendly the relations are between the United States and that government, but the reality is they are. There's a huge difference in treatment between people seeking refuge from governments the U.S. doesn't like versus the ones the U.S. not only likes but has put up and put into power, propped them up at all expense, and has shown itself willing to murder tens of thousands of people to keep them in power.
Let's switch topics again. We've just got a couple minutes left, but this is really important. Nicole, I'm looking at a headline in The Intercept now. It says New York gang database expanded by 70% under Mayor Bill de Blasio. What's going on with this? I mean, Bill de Blasio, when he was on the campaign trail, presented himself as like this great progressive.
He did. I can't not mention he also paraded around his black sons a little bit too much for my taste, but what are you going to do? He absolutely, you know, campaigned on trying to bring the NYPD under control, stopping stop and frisk, you know, making sure that policies like that did not stay in effect in New York City. But instead, we've seen the gang database grow at 342 people per month. You know, in theory, this sounds like a useful thing, right? This is a database where all of these very dangerous people are put. But what we know actually happens is that, you know, these sorts of databases, you can be added to for doing hardly anything, right? This is the sorts of restrictions they talk about are being in a group of people after a certain hour. They talk about, you know, these sorts of requirements to get in the database might include using social media with others. I mean, these are requirements that could literally pertain to any group of people. But what we're seeing is that for the most part, they are pertaining to black and brown youth. 99% of the people who've been added over the past 4 years were non-white people. So, I mean, these are literally black and brown youth who are being added. And these databases are not only used for kind of a digital sort of stop and frisk, right, where you can justify, detaining someone or arresting someone using these databases, but they also can, in some places, be used for enhancements once you actually arrest someone and are trying to sentence someone or kind of beef up charges.
Yeah, Paul, what are your thoughts on this massive expansion of the gang database with all the abuses that Nicole just laid out there?
Well, I think the part of the thing is the first thing that comes up is the lack of due process. You know, the fact that there's no criteria for this, the involuntary nature of it. I think, you know, these are all pretty significant issues. But I think the bigger thing is that, you know, a federal judge stopped the whole stop and frisk thing where hundreds of thousands of primarily young men of color were being stopped and frisked by the New York police with no probable cause for no reason other than the color of their skin. And, you know, so a federal judge stopped that. And now when I read the article by The Intercept about the rise of these databases, I'm kind of wondering, okay, is this just a matter of they stopped the stop and frisk, and now this is what's replacing it? And that's part of what makes me think that that this is just, you know, just the new stop and frisk. They got rid of the stop and frisk because the judge ordered them to, and so now they come up with this. And I think this is part of the thing, too, when you talk about the over-policing of communities, is that, you know, once you're in one database, it's the whole thing, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy of, you know, even though people haven't committed a crime, they haven't been accused of committing a crime, but now they're viewed as basically being criminals. So now it's just a matter of, I think, as one police official put it, of tail 'em, nail 'em, and jail 'em. And that's what where the efforts of the police state are on. And I think as far as like the whole thing about Bill de Blasio supposedly being progressive and stuff like that, I think when it comes to the American police state, political labels don't really matter. Because I think if you look at, in most of the country, it was the so-called liberals that basically built the American police state into the mammoth enterprise it is today. No one has done more at the federal level to build and entrench the domestic police state than Bill Clinton did.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Unfortunately, we're all out of time. We've been joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, and he's also the editor of Prison Legal News. We've been joined in studio by Loud and Clear producer Nicole Roussel. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.